Acts chapter 9. We've been reading, or you have been reading, I've skipped a few verses which we'll be coming back to in forthcoming weeks. But we're going to move on to the journey, the ministry of the Apostle Peter. So Acts chapter 9 verse 32. As Peter travelled about the country, he went to visit the saints in Lydda. There he found a man named Aeneas, a paralytic who had been bedridden for 8 years. Aeneas, Peter said to him, Jesus Christ heals you. Get up and tidy up your mat. Immediately Aeneas got up, and all those who lived in Lydda and Sharon saw him and turned to the Lord. In Joppa there was a disciple named Tabitha, which when translated is Dorcas, which probably doesn't help you much either, does it? Root of the word is gazelle, by the way. Who was always doing good and helping the poor. About that time she became sick and died, and her body was washed and placed in an upstairs room. Lydda was near Joppa, so when the disciples heard that Peter was in Lydda, they sent two men to him and urged him, please come at once. Peter went with them, and when he arrived, he was taken upstairs to the room. All the widows stood around him, crying and showing him the robes and other clothing that Dorcas had made while she was still with them. Peter sent them all out of the room, and he got down on his knees and prayed. Turning towards the dead woman, he said, Tabitha, get up. She opened her eyes, and seeing Peter, she sat up. He took her by the hand and helped her to her feet. And then he called the believers and the widows and presented her to them alive. This became known all over Joppa, and many believed in the Lord. Peter stayed in Joppa for some time with a tanner named Simon. The Apostle Peter gets overlooked, I think, by many of us. We concentrate on the Apostle Paul because we have a lot of letters written by the Apostle Paul and the Apostle Paul's journeys, and his impact on the Christian faith was enormous. We overlook Peter, but we shouldn't. And Luke takes great pains to stop us doing that. He makes a point of coming back to Peter's ministry, although he's going to follow Paul's ministry, partly because Luke and Paul were friends and travelled together, and Luke was present on many of the Apostle Paul's journeys. He does come back to Peter because he wants us all to realise that Peter and Paul were on the same side, that both Peter and Paul were great leaders, not the only leaders, but they were both great leaders in the early church. And we tend to overlook Peter and his influence, at least the Baptists do. Catholics give Peter more emphasis than we do, and we don't give him enough emphasis. I'm sure we don't. So the Apostle Paul is bringing us back to Peter. Well, the last time we had Peter in the story, Peter had been on a missionary, on a journey to find out what the evangelist Philip was up to, and he discovered a large number of Samaritans who'd become Christians. And on the way back, Peter and John said, you know what, we can do this too, we can preach. So having sort of rushed there and passed through all the little towns and villages on the way to get to this meeting they'd set up up in the north, they decided to take their time coming back and stopped off to preach in the cities, in the little villages on their way back, which was a really great thing to do. Now, he's moving west of Jerusalem. He's gone on a trip to visit the saints, or visit the Christians in Lydda. So he's on a preaching trip. Why? Because God is at work there. And what's interesting is that everywhere Peter goes, he finds God at work. God has gone before him. And I'm challenged by that, because that isn't, if I'm to be honest, that's not how I always live. I don't walk into situations thinking, God has gone before me. Therefore, I'm going to see what God's going to do. I tend to think, I'm going into the situation, now God's going to do something, which is the wrong way around, isn't it? When you think about it, God is there before us. Before you walk through the door into a room, God is in that room already. And God is at work in that room. Before you walk into the office, God is there in the office before you at 9 o'clock in the morning. Now, I know sometimes listening to the conversation in the office, you might not think that. But God is there before us. But we think it depends on us. We think nothing's going to happen until we get there. It's not true. And in a sense, on a Monday morning, God is inviting us into his workplace, isn't he? God is inviting us to see what he's been doing when we've not been there. And I find that a huge encouragement. It's also a little bit of a challenge to me, because I need to change my thinking, it seems to me. And I think also, as I look at this episode here of the Apostle Peter, I'm a little bit intimidated by it. Are you not? These are big miracles happening. And I kind of almost feel, whoa, intimidated by that, because I've seen so many miracles during my years as a minister, but nothing quite as dramatic as that. I think, whoa, wouldn't that be great? And I think, actually, wouldn't it be scary? Yeah. But it would be good. So let's take a look at Peter. But I want to come up from Peter. I want to move on a little bit also to Dorcas. There's something happening here. Luke is telling us that there is something happening. And I think we make a bit of a mistake too, because in our books we have the book of Luke, and then the way the New Testament's put together, you get the book of John, and then you've got the book of Acts. So in our New Testament, Luke and Acts are two separate books, but they were never written to be two separate books. In the ancient world, it was very common to write histories in two volumes. One history, but in two volumes. And Luke has done that. And in fact, theologians talk about Luke Acts. Luke apostrophe Acts. They don't talk about Luke and Acts separately. They talk about Luke Acts, if you read the theologians' works. So, really and truly, Luke and Acts a one book. So when we talk about the Gospel of Luke, we're really almost, as it were, inventing a book. Because the Gospel of Luke was never meant to be a standalone. It was meant to seamlessly plug in to the book of Acts. In other words, what Jesus is doing in the book of Luke, he continues to do through the apostles in the book of Acts. Never meant to be two stories. It's one story. It's two phases of what's going on. And that's the theme of the book of Luke and Acts. God at work. I was reading a very funny article by Victoria Corin Mitchell this morning about machines. Apparently, next year Bosch are going to put on the market a machine that parks your car for you. And it's linked to 12 sensors. And if you've got an iPhone, you can have an app. And it'll tell you when it's found a parking space. And then you can get out, shut the door, walk to pavement, call it up on your app, and the car will park itself perfectly. And Victoria, she's very funny. She said, this is actually a new phase. You see, the first phase was when machines obeyed us. The final phase will be when we obey machines. The intermediate phase is a sarcastic phase, when they point out they can do everything better than we can. It's a very funny article. But the book of Luke and Acts, it's all about God moving on. They're phases of God's work. We have the gospel phase with Jesus walking the earth and ministering in power and preaching and teaching. And going to the cross to die for us and rising from the dead and meeting the disciples. And then moving these disciples on and filling them with his spirit. And they go out and they carry on doing what Jesus was doing. So in a sense, what God is doing in your office or in your classroom or in your hall of residence tomorrow is a continuation of what Jesus was doing on earth. It's all just a different phase, but it's the same thing. It's the same movement. So Peter, if he turns to verses 32 to 35, Peter starts doing what he already knows to do. I must confess, this section has been lifted from various writings by a pastor I like. I've never met him, but I do like what he writes on the internet, a guy called Ewan Huffman. We have a vague link in that he's a senior pastor of a church down in the West Country, and Jeff and Marilyn Birch's son, Gary, is the associate pastor in that church. So we really ought to sort of reel that connection in and get Ewan up to preach one time, shouldn't we? But Peter begins to do what Jesus has already modelled for him. This is a point I'm trying to get to. Peter is still living the gospel story. So are we. And he goes to Lydda and he finds a man who's been in bed for 8 years. And the Spirit of God, presumably, Luke doesn't tell us this, but I presume the Spirit of God just comes upon Peter in such a way and speaks to Peter. Peter knows something's going to happen here. He's seen it happen before. Take a quick look. Keep your finger in Acts 9. Flick back to John 5 very quickly, where Peter has seen Jesus do much the same thing. And in John 5, verse 5 to 8, Jesus walks up into an area, into the pool of Bethsaida, where there's kind of lots of people there who are unable to walk or ill or have some kind of infirmity, and because it's a place of healing and they're expecting to be healed. Walks past them all, it comes to one guy and says to him, "Get up, pick up your mat and walk." And the guy does. Guy picks up his mat and walks. And Peter's seen that and it's made an impression. He says, you know what? I've seen that. Acts 3, verses 6 to 8. He's done this before. He and John walk into the temple, and there's a man who's begging. And Peter says, I don't have any money, but I'll tell you what I do have. In the name of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, walk. And a man gets up and walks. So Peter has been this. He's repeating what he has seen before. Jesus has modeled this for him. And he's doing that. And as Christians, you know, that is really how we learn to minister. We watch other people. We're involved in what other people do. We learn from other people and it goes on. Peter is really in his comfort zone. He's been here before. And if we can maybe slip back to verses 32 to 35, he says, "Get up and tidy up your mat," in this version. It's like comes over a bit like a parent, doesn't it? Telling their adolescent son, "Get up and make your bed." But, in fact, the Greek, it's interesting. The Greek literally says, "Make your couch, make your bed," you know. And so making up your bed when you've just been told to get out of it is a bit odd, really. It doesn't, the Greek "tidy up your mat" is almost like get ready to lie down. He's just been told to get up. There is another translation possible, and it might not be what Luke had in mind, but I bring it to you, which is "get up and make your couch," because in those days, people, when they ate at the table, they laid on a couch. And they laid on one arm and ate with one hand, which is why they never invented the knife and fork. And so they have the couch, and Jesus kind of says, well, you know, get up and make up the couch. Let's have a meal together. Let's celebrate. I do like that. You know, you've had a miracle. Let's sit down and eat together. I don't know what the equivalent would be. But Jesus says, get up and go and order a takeaway from Andrea's Tyson Takeaway in Holyhead Road, you know? And we'll celebrate with a takeaway and prawn crackers and some of Andrea's specialities. Let's have a Chinese together to celebrate your healing. Maybe that's what Jesus is saying. If it is, I like it. Anything that involves food, I'm there. And if it involves food in the kingdom of God, well, even better. You've been healed, let's eat. You've had a miracle, let's eat. God's done a work in your life, let's eat, let's celebrate, let's enjoy ourselves. Well, and then we come to verse 35. All those who lived in Lydda and Sharon saw him and turned to the Lord, it says. Interesting that it doesn't always happen like that. Miracles in the United Kingdom scare people. We've booked Nigel Wright to come and preach here in October again. Nigel was principal of Spurgeon's College and one of our great Christian Baptist leaders. And Nigel's coming over. He retired to Cheshire, so it's a little pop over the border to preach in a principality. And he's very keen to come. But Nigel has done some very interesting stuff, because Nigel is one of the people who brought the power evangelism thing, John Wimber, to the UK. And at the time, Nigel and his colleagues were believing that when God began to move in power and began to do healings, you know, people would just flock to the church to hear more. But what they found was that it didn't happen in the UK. And Nigel is an incredibly intelligent and perceptive man. He's done some work, and he said, you know, one of the reasons is that when God starts doing miracles, British people back off because they get scared. They think they're being drawn into some kind of weird sect that they can't control. So, whereas in New Testament culture, when the miracles started happening, people began to flock in because they wanted some of it. In the UK, when miracles start happening, people are scared they're going to be asked for their money or whatever. And they sort of begin to back away and hold us where the weird happy clappies down the road. Interesting. Culturally, where it happens. I don't know I have no idea what the solution is, by the way. I throw that out sometimes. I throw things out because I know the answer myself. You tell me. So Peter is doing what he's done before. And as we move on to verses 39 to 41, we begin to see that Peter is then called to another miracle. And in this case, as we saw, it's Dorcas or Tabitha. And she's died. And he walks in, and he'd been here before. He was there when Jesus did the same kind of thing. There was a Jewish leader of the synagogue called Jairus, and his daughter took ill, and as Jesus was on the way, the daughter died, and Jesus got there. And when he got there, people were crying because the little girl, she was a young girl, she was dead. And Jesus walks into that situation, tells everyone to leave, and goes into that bedroom. And if you go to Mark chapter 5, verse 41, Jesus took her by the hand and said to her, little girl, I say to you, get up. I think I've cut a bit out there. What the original says was, he says to the little girl, Talitha koum. Talitha koum, which means, little girl, I say to you, get up. Which compares nicely with what Peter says to Tabitha. He says, Tabitha koum. Tabitha, get up. Talitha koum, little girl, get up. Tabitha koum, Tabitha, get up. Same situation, a few years down the line, just one letter difference, and the same thing happens. the woman rises from the dead. He puts the puts people outside. Some commentators think he's putting people outside because of their unbelief. And as Jesus did, because he did put the unbelievers outside, they're only left with those who believe the miracle could happen. Don't know if that was the case. I kind of hope it's not, because I'm scared I might be counted among the unbelievers. And I'm really, sometimes I get worried that it's my unbelief that's stopping God doing more. I just don't believe he's going to do more. So he doesn't. Maybe that's the case. It frightens me sometimes. But either way, Peter is doing what he's been taught to do. He's been working as a team. So the point is that Peter's always worked in a team. He's always learned something and passed what he's learned on to other people. So let's move to verses 41 to 43. He's moving in the power of the Spirit, and he's staying for a time in Joppa with a tanner named Simon. I think if I were going to stay with somebody, I wouldn't choose a tanner. Not only did the hides stink, but in order to tan them, they used stale urine. And you thought Travelodge was slimming it, didn't you? But anyway, he stays with Simon the tanner. On the good side, it's on the coast, so he could go fishing. So, you know, maybe that was the attraction, to get some fishing in while he was down there. But Peter spends time working with others. There's a fascinating article going around the internet at the moment, and already two people from Penrith have brought it to my attention through Facebook. A fascinating article written by a personal trainer who's also a Christian leader, comparing life as a personal trainer with life as a Christian leader, and saying that actually personal trainers do it better. That if we applied the same principles to spiritual growth and spiritual discipline as we do to personal training, the church would be in much better shape. And if we spent as much time on learning to pray and praying together, if personal trainers and gyms did things the way the church did, they would spend the best part of the week sitting down reading magazines about training and being fit. And he said, we don't put things into practice. But here we go. We're left with Tabitha or Dorcas. And I don't know if you picked up in the reading. There were things about Dorcas that it tells us. And I want to connect it with Luke's gospel, because it tells us that Dorcas, she went about doing good and helping the poor. And when Peter gets there, there are people who are not only grieving Dorcas' death, but they're also showing him the clothes she's made for them. She's clothed the poor and the needy round about her. She's, in her own way, modelling the gospel to the people round about her in the same way that Peter is modelling the gospel by healing and by preaching. They're both doing what happened in the gospel story in the church's story. There's no break. It's a continuum. And that ministry of ministering to the poor is all part of the miracle. Dorcas is doing her own little miracles all along, and that suddenly leads to the big miracle when she gets a new lease of life and gets back to the sewing machine and gets back to ministering to the poor. And what's coming through this is this, that there is a process going on and it's spreading. And everybody's involved in that process. I was in an interesting talk recently by one of the professors from the university, and you would expect a professor from Bangor University to give an interesting talk, and it was. And it was by one of the Welsh professors talking about the Welsh language, and it kind of clicked with me because he was talking about... some of you are Welsh learners, aren't you? I can see the worry lines and the grey hairs and the red eyes from all that swatting. When you learn Welsh, okay, you dysgu Cymraeg, yeah? When you learn Welsh, you dysgu Cymraeg. You learn Welsh. When you teach Welsh, what do? You dysgu Cymraeg. It's the same word. So it can get confusing sometimes if you're listening to people. They say they dysgu Cymraeg. You don't know if they're learning Welsh or teaching it. It's usually fairly obvious, it must be said. And Jenny Francis said, you know, the problem is that we had to invent a word for lecturing in Welsh, addysgu Cymraeg. He said it's a made-up word. And he said we've actually violated the original intention of the Welsh language, because in the Welsh language, learning and teaching is the same thing. It's all part of the same process. Teacher and pupil are doing the same thing. They're doing that learning thing together. They're involved in the process. And he said that's a very beautiful thing that our modern politically correct Welsh has ruined. And what we're seeing here is how the church works. It teaches and it learns at the same time. It models and it passes on at the same time. And as it does so, it rolls into new areas. And we're going to see as we go through the book of Acts that it becomes for everybody. That it begins, the book begins, as we saw, in the hills of Judah with a poor family and a local man, a poor man, who gets his turn to serve as a priest in the temple. It might have been the only time in his life he did. And he gets a bit of a shock. He also gets a baby. And the whole thing begins to move on from there. But it begins as a very Jewish event around the temple. And then it begins suddenly to expand. And it becomes for everybody. It becomes a good news, not just for the Jews, but for the Samaritans. And then for the Greeks. And then for the people of Wales. And then it becomes for the foreign students who are walking our streets. It becomes good news for the Bulgarians who are moving to our green and pleasant land. It becomes good news for the tribesmen in the hills of Papua New Guinea, or the Brazilian landless, or it becomes good news for everybody. People who, in every part of the world, people of Australia, for the whining Poms who moved to Australia and don't like it, it becomes good news for them too. It's grown. It begins in this little group of people, this little family, in Jerusalem, in Judah. And now it's spreading. And as it spreads, people are being drawn into its ministry and are beginning to work. And finally, if you just go back to the verse 31 in chapter 9. I want to finish on this one. Luke links it up with these words. Then the church throughout Judea, Galilee and Samaria enjoyed a time of peace. It was strengthened and encouraged by the Holy Spirit. It grew in numbers, living in the fear of the Lord. He says that, you know, there are times when everything's right and things start to take off. And I'm so praying that 2014 is one of those times for Penrith. I really am. The time is right. It's time to see God at work. And God always works unexpectedly. And Peter certainly didn't see these miracles happening when he went to the area, just went on a preaching trip to encourage the churches and finds God at work. And I'm just praying that God is ahead of us in 2014. Well, I don't know why I'm praying that, because he is. And I'm praying that you and I walk in to God at work in 2014. That we no longer give in to negativity and the thought that nothing's going to happen and nothing can change and things are going to be bad. God is at work. Remember that God is with you when you walk into every room. Remember that you're part of the story too. That you are the gospel story of Jesus. You are the gospel of Luke in 2014. Because it doesn't finish at the end of the book of Acts. Don't please tell me that you're not important. Because you are. Please don't tell me that God's not going to answer your prayers, because he's going to. Please don't tell me there's nothing happening. Because it is. It's just, well, you and I, we're not finding it.